Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet an Iowan with an eclectic career. She's a NASA engineer and a fire performer, world record-holding whipcracker, magician, aerialist, among other things. But first, understanding our DNA and genetic heritage is easier than ever. You can send in a vial of saliva and find out a great deal about your family history. Armed with a few names and dates, internet databases can help you fill in the blanks on your family tree. But what does all of this mean about who you are? That's a question that Lori Erickson traveled far to answer. She writes about her journey in her new book, The Soul of the Family Tree, Ancestors, Stories, and the Spirits We Inherit. The release of the book is being celebrated with an outdoor launch party at Harvest Preserve in Iowa City, put on by Prairie Lights Bookstore, tomorrow, August 25th at 5:30 p.m., and Lori is here with me now. Hello, Lori.
Thank you for having me, Charity. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you grew up in Decorah, Iowa, a very Nordic area of the state, in a place where people celebrate their Norwegian heritage quite a lot. So when you were growing up, was that part of your concept of who you were?
Well, I don't think you can grow up in Decorah with the last name of Erickson and not identify with the Norwegian-American character of the play. So I will say, though, that you know, when you grow up surrounded by something, you take it for granted, and often you don't appreciate it very much. And so it was only once I started diving into my family roots and cultural heritage that I really came to appreciate that town and that inheritance that I've been given.
Now, you describe yourself as somewhat reluctant to dive into genealogy, or maybe coming to it a little bit late. What made you want to start putting together your family tree?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that genealogy is, in some ways, the most boring hobby in the world. You know, it's about dead people, and it's about other people's relatives. And so really, it's only of interest to you, I think, if it's your relatives. And so one of the challenges in researching and writing a book, certainly, is to make it interesting to other people. But my own genealogical quest really started with losing relatives and realizing that, those stories really had largely vanished. I'd lost the chance to collect a lot of them, but that there was a larger story to tap into. And so that's what I decided that I would do in my book.
So in thinking about your relatives that you were losing and losing their stories, by starting to do that genealogical work, you're not necessarily finding those stories. In some ways, you're preserving names and, mm-hmm. and dates and making sure that this information is available to your offspring or their offspring someday if they become interested. But as you started putting those pieces of your family tree puzzle together, what did you find yourself longing for, wishing that you could get from those names?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I should say I'm a really bad genealogist in the sense that I am not the sort of person who does the painstaking research and double checks everything and triple checks. And that's really important in genealogy. But I was always from the very beginning interested in the stories. And I think part of it was this quest to try to understand who I was, how I'd grown up, and the sort of people I'd grown up around, the fact that people in my family, especially menfolk, are very short of words, a kind of stoic determinism, that you just put your head down and get through it. Where did that come from? And then also this question of what happened to Scandinavian Americans, that our heritage includes that sort of taciturn sort of, stick with it no matter what happens. But it also includes the Vikings, who have a very violent history in Northern Europe. And so part of the larger question of my book is what happened that the country that once terrorized Europe is now giving out the Nobel Peace Prize?
You also, as part of doing your own family research, you did do one of the DNA tests. Mm-hmm. You describe filling a little tiny vial with saliva. What led you to want to do that? I know that's something that a lot of people are excited about. Some people are very uncomfortable about sending their DNA off to be sequenced. What made you want to do it?
Well, part of it, I think, was peer pressure. Especially a few years ago, everyone was doing it in my social circle. And it was so fascinating to hear people's stories and to hear the way it stimulated conversations. I learned things about friends that I had never known before. One friend, for example, whose grandparents were from Lebanon, I didn't realize that. And also, I think if you write memoirs, you don't have a real strong sense of personal privacy. And so I do think there are issues with having your DNA sequenced, but it really wasn't applicable to me. And so, I cheerfully spit into a vial and just went from there. So
I think a lot of people maybe are hoping for some surprises when they send that DNA in. I haven't done mine. My brother has done his. There were no surprises. And I thought, well, that's, $100 I can save. But were you hoping that there might be some surprises?
Oh, yes. Well, I knew it would be largely Norwegian, as it was. But I was really hoping for more Irish blood, Irish DNA. And there was just a little bit of a trace of it. But I am so undiverse ethnically. I am almost all Norwegian in my heritage. So there were really no surprises. No, I got what I thought I was.
So you are a woman who loves to travel and you love history. So in starting to put together your own family history, you also delve deeper into Scandinavian past. And what is it particularly about the Vikings that has just ignited your imagination?
Well, part of it goes back to my childhood when I recognized that there was a real similarity between my name, Laurie Erickson, and Leif Erickson, the Norse explorer who around the year 1000 was likely the first European to land in North America. And so I always said I was descended from him on the basis of that admittedly very thin connection of the same last name and sort of a similar
right,
first name.
Right, which Erickson is a pretty
common
last name.
It's pretty common, yes, yeah. Yes. And so I've always had an interest in Leif Erickson. And then I think in larger terms, the Vikings, they're just so interesting. Even if we're appalled by the violence, they were explorers, they were surveyors, they were resolute, they traveled all around the world to 40 different countries. They left their imprint on our language, on the days of the week, from Wednesday, which is named after Woden in Old Saxon, to Thursday, which is Thor's day. Bluetooth on our phones is actually named after Harald Bluetooth, who was a Viking chieftain. And so the runes are in each of our phones. So just tracing those cultural influences was really fascinating to me.
You kind of skipped a lot of things in thinking about your heritage in Scandinavia. The part that really led your forefathers directly to coming to the United States seemed to be the part that interested you the least. You wanted to go back a lot farther.
Yes, yes. And so I went back in imagination as well as from a sort of a passion for history. But then I also did. I chose two ancestors somewhat at random because I really like the Norwegian-ness of their names. They had odd Norwegian vowels, the O with a slash through it, etc. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to choose them at random and then follow them because I knew no one is going to be interested in hearing about all of my Norwegian relatives. And they turned out to be a really, I think, interesting couple to pin this larger story on. They came to, they immigrated in the year 1850, so they were on the first edge of Norwegian immigration. They happened to be baptized in the most beautiful church in Norway, so thank you, fate, for doing that, because I got the chance to visit it. So in the book, I try to tell my story, but then use it as a springboard for other people's imagination and discoveries.
Well, and you go looking for, as you say in the title, the soul of the family tree. Again, we can find out a lot about our DNA and we can put together a family tree and we can see all of these names and dates and we know where people came from and maybe we can even learn why they came. But just the fact that we inherited their DNA doesn't necessarily say very much about who we are. And I think that that's maybe that's a very American way to feel, because so many of us, if we were descended from the Europeans that came to this country, especially in the 1850s, these are people who had nothing to lose. They were, many of them, living in such dire circumstances in their home countries that they wanted to leave and start a new life and not look back. So it is interesting to think about trying to uncover that heritage that has almost been purposely cast aside.
Mm-hmm. Well, like many immigrants, they wanted to leave the past behind in a lot of ways. So I would say in Decora especially, there was the countervailing tendency of really trying to save Norway in a sense as a type of time capsule. But I think that impulse to, you know, what do you take and what do you keep? And also the fact that when we look back at our ancestors, there's so much to choose from. I mean, if you go far enough back, I think it's like 10 generations, we have 65,000 ancestors, you know, the size of Iowa City. And who do you choose? Who are your role models? And so, but I very much in the book wanted to get away from just looking at DNA, because I think there are so many people for whom that really doesn't apply. If they're adopted, or, you know, if they're alienated from their family, their immediate family, I still think genealogy has some things to teach them.
I think we also sometimes fall into a trap of a little bit of romanticizing our ancestors. And of course, we know that they were not perfect. I don't have to look very far into my family tree to find some real imperfections. Do you think that that's a danger when people start to look into their genealogy?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that people are sometimes shocked. I have a whole chapter in the book on badly behaving relatives, starting with the Vikings and going down through the centuries. But I think actually, if you do enough genealogy, I think it does tend to give you a wider perspective and to realize it's hard to stand on your moral high horse when you do genealogy, because you realize every family has its villains and its heroes, and often they're the same. You know that human choices are complicated.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Lori Erickson. Her most recent book is The Soul of the Family Tree, Ancestors, Stories, and the Spirits We Inherit. It is out today, and the release of the book is being celebrated with an outdoor launch party at Harvest Preserve in Iowa City, put on by Prairie Lights Bookstore, tomorrow, August 25th at 5:30 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, we will meet April Jennifer Choi. She is a NASA engineer and a fire performer, whipcracker, magician, and aerialist. She recently appeared on a new game show on ABC, and we'll talk about that as well. Right now, I'm talking with Lori Erickson. She is the author of The Soul of the Family Tree, Ancestors, Stories, and the Spirits We Inherit. She started doing her family research, learning about the Norwegians in her past, but then dove a whole lot deeper into history to try to understand what her heritage tells her about herself. And also, Lori, you clearly just really love Vikings, which I think it is interesting, because I do think that there is this fascination with the Vikings. And there's so much blood and betrayal as part of the Viking stories. And so people seem to be fascinated by them, want to associate with them. And then at the same time, if you start looking very deep, you're like, oh, there's a lot of unsavory unsavory stuff going on here. But for people who don't know much about the Vikings beyond, you know, thinking about horned hats and things that aren't necessarily real, tell us a little bit about Viking history, because the Vikings really did travel far. They touched the globe.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I should make clear that not everyone in Scandinavia was a Viking. In fact, probably only maybe 10 to 15% of people, mostly men, went raiding. And that's what Viking means, is basically to be a raider or a pirate. And the rest of people stayed home and behaved themselves and eked out a very meager living on very, very poor soil. But of those who went raiding, it was often a summer occupation. It was often done by young men who were looking to earn a bride price, perhaps, or get established. And so then there were the captains of the ships, the financiers of them, who were in it in a larger sort of way. But the Vikings were not, they were opportunists, I would say. They were, I think I say in the book, they were either warrior merchants or merchant warriors, depending on how you squint at the historical record. And where they went, if they could trade with people, yeah, they did that. Sometimes they settled down. They settled Russia. In fact, Russia, the word, probably comes from the name of a tribe of Vikings, Rus. But then they also raided. They also took slaves. They also burned down a lot of places. They stole a lot of silver and gold altar pieces from monasteries in particular. And so, I think one reason why we're more comfortable with the Vikings than we are with other groups who had a mixed reputation is that they're far enough in the past. We do romanticize them, even though I think that that's probably not the best thing to do in a lot of ways. But, TV shows, movies. But then the other part of the Vikings, I think, is Norse mythology, which is intertwined with the Viking story. And the Viking gods and goddesses are fascinating. I mean, what a crew they were.
Well, and I think that Norse mythology is something that shows up in so many different places. People who have never thought that they've researched Norse mythology know a little bit about Norse mythology, especially if they're Marvel Comics fans, right?
That's right.
It's definitely part of our culture. And you mentioned Leif Erikson earlier, who you grew up believing was one of your ancestors, and very well may be. We can't disprove it.
Who can disprove
right?
it? That's right.
And his connection with North America is that, as you said, he was probably the first European to set foot on North America. And he created a small settlement in Newfoundland, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The far tip of Newfoundland is called Lonzo Meadows, and it's the only authenticated Viking site in North America. It's a beautiful historical site managed by the Canadian government.
And he didn't stay there very long.
No. He himself probably only spent a couple of summers there, perhaps, but the Viking settlement lasted perhaps 10 years, and then they folded up and went home. And there were... there were a variety of reasons for going home. It was just so remote from the rest of Scandinavia. There were starting to be conflicts with the indigenous peoples in the area. And they gave up and went home. And for a long time, it was thought that the Vinland stories of that settlement were probably fictional. They're included in a body of literature called the Icelandic Sagas. But then in the 1960s, they actually found the archaeological evidence for it. And that's what you can see if you go to Lonzo Meadows today.
Yeah, tell me what you can see, because you had just an extraordinary experience there.
Well, it takes a long time to get to Lonzo Meadows. You long flights and a long drive up the Viking Trail, which goes up the side of Newfoundland. And you finally get to Lonzo Meadows, and it's this windswept corner of land next to the sea. You can see icebergs floating by in the bay. There are the remains of the archaeological site, which are basically turf houses that were there. And so they've marked those by turf walls. But then they have recreated the buildings. And that's the really fascinating part. They're staffed by first-person interpreters who play members of the expeditions. And that's when you can really step into sort of the magic of that time period. And that's what I did. And I introduced myself as a cousin of Leif Erikson to everybody. And they were suitably impressed. Most places, it doesn't confer a lot of cachet to be a relative of Leif Erikson, but in Lonzo Meadows, it does.
So what did it feel like to you to be there? Because, this is a place that has played such a big role in your imagination for so long.
It was wonderful. I must say, even though, and I know it's an imaginative connection, but when But when our guide said, well, this was Leif's house, you know, that they have a pretty good guess of which one it was. And I just I kneeled down and I felt the ground, and I just had this sense of connection to not only to Leif, but to a larger story of exploration, of risk taking, of travel. You know, because Leif was certainly someone who loved to travel, and I loved to travel as well.
You also, in your travels, found another ancestor that just feels like a spiritual ancestor to you, and she was actually Leif Erikson's sister-in-law. Tell me about her.
So Gudrid the Far Traveler, who I ran across when I saw her statue in Iceland. And
which is a wonderful story, because you just needed to go to the bathroom.
That's right. And in Iceland, there are no public restrooms when you're out in the back of Beyond. And so I did my business and then happened to see this statue, this small stylized statue of a Norse woman standing in a stylized Viking boat with a small child on her shoulder. And the sign accompanying it said that this was Gudrid the Far Traveler, and she was the sister-in-law of Leif Erikson. She was probably the most well-traveled woman of the Middle Ages. She sailed to Newfoundland, lived there for 3 years, gave birth to the first child of European descent in North America. When the colony failed, she went back to Greenland, then Iceland. And then later in life, she actually walked on pilgrimage to Rome, which is just an extraordinary thing when you think of the conditions of the time. She was a widow at the time. And she was renowned for her bravery and her wisdom and her kindness. And after she died, she was given the name of Gudrid the Far Traveler. And this was one of the descriptions of her in the sagas that I just loved. She was a woman who knew how to behave around strangers, which is such a wonderful thing. If you think about it, it certainly implies that there were a lot of people who didn't know how to behave around strangers.
Well, I think that's still true. That's definitely still true. Well, and she was a woman with agency at a time when a lot of women didn't have agency.
Yes, yes. And she actually gets more words in the Icelandic sagas than Leif Erikson does. There's just wonderful sort of set pieces of her interacting with people. And she was a force of nature. She really was. And she straddled the pagan world and the Christian world, the new world and the old world. She was comfortable being on the boundaries, I think.
I'm talking with Lori Erikson. Her most recent book is The Soul of the Family Tree, Ancestors, Stories, and the Spirits We Inherit. On the subject of paganism and Christianity, you also spent time exploring the spirituality of the Vikings, which led you in some very interesting directions. But why was that important for you? We know the myths, but you tried to take it more seriously, to really understand the spiritual connection with these gods and goddesses.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is I have two great passions in life. One is travel and one is spirituality. And so it's natural, I think, that I would be interested in the spirituality of these people. I also am always interested in the ways in which old stories get reused and revivified. And so there is a thriving Norse pagan community in the upper Midwest. I got the chance to go to a pagan festival in Minneapolis, which was fascinating. And I learned a lot from a woman named Kari Toring, who has developed a spiritual path that's firmly rooted in Scandinavian traditions, but also is for the modern age. And so it was fascinating hanging around with her. We went to a Viking festival together. And then I also learned how to read Norse runes, which is a form of a little bit like tarot cards, I would say, but it's something that dates way, way back in the Norse tradition. And I thought it would be a hoot to learn how to do it, and it was fascinating.
You also came up with a couple of opportunities to dress in traditional Viking clothing and really engage with the people who reenact this part of history. Why was that an important experience for you to have, and what did you learn from it?
Well, if anyone is interested in researching their ancestors, I really encourage them to dress up like their ancestors, because there's something about, you know, clothes make the man or the woman, and something about dressing in the clothing of the past and then walking around other people who are also dressed in the clothing of the past and smelling the campfires and eating the foods and hearing the clang of the blacksmith's hammer. All of that, it's visceral, it's experiential. And even though it is play acting in a sense, it also helps us take that time travel that is hard to do if you're just sitting at a computer screen or reading a book, for that matter.
So what do you think you learned from putting on the garments and walking around and one day in the cold and the rain?
I learned that in some ways it would have been nice to be a Viking woman. I mean, they had quite a bit of status, especially if you were, you know, in the upper half of the social structure. But I also think that it was just physically hard. You know, it's a harsh climate, and the wool or linen is not that warm. And especially after it started to rain at this reenactment, I got very damp, very cold, and very miserable very quickly.
And I was struck by you visited a recreation of a Viking ship, and they had cabins down below, but told you that the Vikings wouldn't have had cabins down below. They would have maybe created structures up on deck, but they would have been on deck throughout their entire journeys. That sounds like a cold and miserable
yes.
lifestyle for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So this book is a really fun exploration of your ancestry, of the history of the Vikings, which is interesting. And I learned a whole lot. I knew a little. Now I know a whole lot more. You make it a lot of fun to explore. But I also feel like you were looking for something more. And you describe it in a number of different ways. But tell me what you found, your personal connection to the past and what it means to you.
Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to Gudrid the Far Traveler and what I said about how she really straddled two worlds. She straddled boundaries. And the more I learned about her, the more I realized that I also feel that way, that I'm in one world and in another world and not totally at home in both, you know, that in terms of religious belief and, you know, all the turmoil going on in the culture and feeling, you know, at home and not at home. And I really admired the grace with which she straddled different continents and countries and traditions. And so that's part of it. I also think being in Norway gave me a different sense of myself, that I think if you do genealogy, it's really hard to be an individualist in the same way, because you realize how much has been given to you, how much other people sacrificed so you can be who you are. And maybe perhaps how many people screwed up so that you can be the way you are.
Well, and I was just going to say that you do a nice job not romanticizing your ancestors and the history. And just to revisit that is a very dangerous path that a lot of people take, where we romanticize what has come before and choose not to see the mistakes or the cruelties.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, these really terrible things that have brought us to where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a really interesting concept called, that's from Old Norse, from the Viking Age, called Urlag, which has to do with what sort of it's fate or destiny, and that when you're born, your Urlag has been created by your ancestors. You also create Urlag then for your descendants. And there's this idea that if you have inherited a part of the Urlag that is frayed or broken, that you can reweave that and you can send healing back. And I really, that's a metaphysical concept that I think is really applicable to for a lot of these issues that we're talking about.
Do you feel like this journey and really changed you?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Yeah. Of all the books I've done, this was by far the most fun. And I think the one that made me change my mind about who I am the most.
So with just a minute and a half left, what do you think the most important thing is that you did learn about yourself?
I think that I come from a long line of people who took risks and made the best of it, and that strength I hope is inherited, and that I can continue using it and relying on it going forward in my own life.
And when you see people, and we do this all over the place, we've got the Minnesota Vikings, we've got a Viking ship in Decorah, we love to put on the horned helmets. When you see people engaging with that heritage in the very shallow way that we engage with it, what do you wish people knew about the Vikings and about what maybe we could learn from them?
Well, I would tell them to read my book, of course, but I would also say The Vikings are really multifaceted, and it's not just one story, it's many stories, and that their story is our story, whether or not you have Scandinavian DNA.
If you were to start this journey again, what piece of advice would you give somebody who may be just starting to look into their family's past?
I know exactly what I would say, and that's interview your older relatives while they're still alive. And I missed that chance. I did some of it, but not nearly enough. And I wish I could go back in time and learn more.
All right. And interview the older relatives who may not even be that old. It's good to talk to them now,
yes,
right?
Yes. Don't put it off. Yes.
Well, Lori Erickson, congratulations, and thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Charity.
The book is The Soul of the Family Tree, Ancestors' Stories and the Spirits We Inherit. It just came out today, and there will be a launch party tomorrow put on by Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at Harvest Preserve in Iowa City. That's tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Coming up in just a moment, we will meet a woman who grew up in Iowa who has an eclectic career, April Jennifer Choi. She is a model, dancer, fire performer, a world record-holding whipcracker, and a NASA engineer. We'll find out more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. April Jennifer Choi is a woman of many talents. She is a model, dancer, fire performer, a world record-holding whipcracker, magician, an aerialist who recently appeared on ABC's The Hustler, a game show hosted by Craig Ferdekson. She's also a NASA engineer who grew up in Iowa City. And just a few years ago, photos from her dramatic Iowa wedding went viral. They're still making sparks on the internet. And we decided we needed to meet her. April is on the line with me now. Hello, April.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And you do have the most eclectic resume I think I've ever read. So let's go back to the beginning a little bit. You grew up in Iowa City. And as I mentioned, you're an engineer. So as you were growing up, were you drawn to that kind of area of study?
Yes, I've always loved math and science, and as I go through like grade school through high school, people kept encouraging me to pursue math and science. So I ended up joining a bunch of science clubs as well as math clubs, and actually competed in Iowa's regional math league from Iowa City High.
Nice. So where did this other side, this more creative and dramatic side, really start for you?
I would say that it started when I ended up going to Iowa City High's Kung Fu Club, because it was just something that was not common, not something you don't hear about. And from Kung Fu and martial arts, I went into dance, and then from dance, I went into the circus arts.
And so you weren't one of these little girls taking dance classes and, you know, doing that kind of stuff earlier on? This was something that you found as a teenager?
I was one of those little girls who went to dance classes and did the recitals. However, I didn't really pursue more of my artistic side until I got into about the college era. I was kind of definitely more pursuant toward the hard sciences and mathematics, and I didn't come out of my shell until I was kind of exploring things at the University of Iowa.
Did you feel like there was pressure on you as a gifted young woman in math and science to really focus on that? Was there pressure to maybe not explore creative arts?
I would say the pressure came with, similar to the previous guest, Lori Erickson, from my heritage, which was a little less murderous, to pursue kind of the mathematical, scientific sides. I always joke that my parents allowed me three career paths, and that was either engineering, law, or medicine.
Okay. I think a lot of people can relate to that story. So as you started exploring that more creative side, how did you feel about it? I mean, obviously it was something that really was attractive to you, but did it feel almost illicit?
I felt like it was a path that I didn't originally thought would be something that would open up to me. One of the wonderful things about going to the University of Iowa was I was able to participate in so many student organizations. I think I was a participant in about 20, and I actually was a chair, co-chair, officer, and over a dozen different student organizations. And one of them was the University of Iowa Swing Club, of which I ended up taking a huge part in, and then later on, utilizing that kind of springboard my performance career.
Oh, wow. And you mentioned the circus arts, and you are a fire performer, a fire eater, among other things.
Yep.
Tell me when you discovered the circus arts, because they're a little bit harder to find, or at least they used to be.
So, unfortunately, I did have an issue with my computer, and I lost my master's thesis, which required me to rewrite it. However, that did give me an entire another semester where I was enrolled as a student but didn't have to take classes. Because of that, I got one full semester where I got to just travel around and go to cool things, and I decided to explore my more artistic side. And from that point, I actually ended up hired as a dance instructor to teach at a circus festival. It's a festival that celebrates the circus arts, and they wanted me to teach dance arts. But because I was attending it, I was allowed to take a bunch of other classes and eventually fell in love with the circus arts learning them.
Wow. So that extra semester, which I'm sure didn't feel like a gift at first, turned out to be a gift for you.
Yeah, it was one of those things where it's like, oh, no, I'm not going to get it. I'll graduate in December instead of May. But then I spent the summer and then all next semester just traveling around, and it was probably the happiest mistake of my life.
So,
well, minus the rapid, like having to type in 300 some pages of your thesis over again.
So in starting to explore the circus arts, I mentioned that you are a world record holding whip cracker. When did you first pick up a whip?
So actually at that circus festival, it was called Flow Fest. It was held in Kentucky. And there is an instructor there by the name of Brian Schenk, who goes by Phoenix Online. He not only taught me my first whip crack, but he gave me my first major gig, which was in 2012 at the Indianapolis Super Bowl Village, which I really kind of used as a springboard to dive into professional performing arts.
What can you do with a whip?
Oh, wow. That's actually a rather long list nowadays. I have about somewhere in the 20s of world records, about a dozen of them are Guinness World Records, and I've toured with Guinness World Records and done live appearances with NBC, ABC, Fox, Disney, Discovery, the Travel Channel, and various other places internationally. And most of my records are basically targeting records. So the most number of cups hit with a whip, the most number of balloons hit with the whip in a minute, the most number of eggs broken with a whip, the most number of candles put out with a whip, as well as things as like the longest whip, the fastest whip, and a few others.
That kind of precision kind of makes me think about engineering. Do you think there's a relationship between your love of math and engineering and your love of whip cracking?
Oh, definitely. So my master's degree was specifically in compressible flows, which basically means really, really fast. Air is considered a compressible fluid once you're moving at really high velocities. So I did essentially supersonic computational fluid dynamics, which gave me a really good understanding of whip dynamics. I ended up doing a partnership with Destin of Smarter Every Day, which is a YouTube channel available for everybody to view, which then we actually dove into the physics of whip cracking and using a whip that held the record for the world's loudest whip through Guinness World Records. We actually got to see the development of the shockwave using Schlieren imaging for the first time in history.
Wow. Have you felt pulled in one direction or another. I mean, you have met with success as a performer, and we can talk more about that side, but also you're an engineer with NASA. So that feels like two full-time jobs. Have you ever felt like you had to choose?
So I definitely got pulled in one direction or another, and it was really kind of whatever happened at the time. I ended up, unfortunately, working at a location where they ran out of funding, in which case then I was laid off, and then I pursued performing arts. And then later on, I was offered an opportunity at Caterpillar, and I took it. And then later on, they ran out of funding, so I once again had to go find a different career path. And I've actually jumped back and forth between being a full-time performer and a full-time engineer through several different fields. So I was like a consulting engineer, and then I was a professional whipcracker, and then I was a mechanical engineer, and then I was a software engineer, and then I was a fire eater, and then I was an aerialist, and then I was a professional, I can't even remember the whole list, but it just kept bouncing between career paths.
Where do you stand right now?
So right now, I still do television appearances on occasion, following all COVID restrictions when I get tested nearly daily. And then I also work a full-time job managing one of the engineering divisions at Kennedy Space Center.
That doesn't sound possible, actually. I mean, how do you find that balance?
Oh, my God. So much time management. I am married to like 8 different calendars. I have my work calendar, my personal calendar, my wife's calendar, several of my partner's calendars, my performance calendar, and they're all meshed together, which like, oh, I happen to have this, 20-minute free block at 10:41 on Tuesday that I can reserve for an interview on Iowa Public Radio.
Well, I really appreciate that you did that. You recently appeared on The Hustler on ABC, and I'm sorry I didn't get to see the appearance. It was on in July, and I was away. But tell me about that experience and how it came about.
So I've actually appeared on ABC a few times. The one previous to this was actually The Gong Show, which is a reboot of an old television show. And I stayed in contact with the casting producers. They found that I was a very interesting character and that I would be somebody that would benefit them greatly as being one of the characters on the show of The Hustler. They said that given the amount of eclectic things I've done in my past, everything from building my own motorcycle, being a rocket scientist, playing in multiple bands, being a multi-instrumentalist, as you said, being a model, a fire eater, a world record whipcracker. Those are all areas I think would be very, very fun to have as clues on the show of The Hustler.
So what was the experience like?
It was very similar to all my previous experiences, with the exception of like lots and lots of COVID testing and following restrictions, because that was a different environment. Not being able to interface with many of the people or the film crew, one, because of the clues. They didn't want to give the clues away, as well as just being in a pandemic environment while still trying to film a television show.
I want to ask you, before we run out of time, you got married in Iowa back in 2018, and as part of your wedding, you and your wife both lit your wedding dresses on fire, and this incredible image that you created ended up going viral. So many, many people have seen photos from your wedding. But tell me a little bit about where that idea came from.
So I met my wife in Cedar Rapids, and then I spent a good majority of my life in Cedar Rapids dancing, as well as a good amount of modeling and photography there, and met a bunch of photographers there and a bunch of models, of which I shot as well as modeled for a bunch of different shoots. We really wanted to incorporate fire into our shoots, and eventually, working with a couple of bridal photographers, we also wanted to include the dresses. So at some point, we started lighting wedding dresses on fire for fun. I was probably 6 or so photo shoots where I was either the photography organizer, the photographer, or the model. And then because we had a photographer up there by the name of Michael Wong, who works with Studio Reserve, which is a bridal photography studio, we decided that for our wedding, we wanted to make it a little bit bigger. So now we wanted 2 people on fire, And we had plenty of safeties, as I said. We're friends with so many fire performers, medical professionals, that we had so many people who were willing to help out perform this particular stunt. So at the end of our wedding, we ended up designing these very long trains with a whole bunch of safety elements in them, and then pouring a whole bunch of fuel, various different types of fuel for proper fuel control, and lighting them up on fire to develop a wonderful photo that I'm very, very proud of.
Yeah, it's really, really stunning. And of course, people can find these images on the internet, because when something goes viral, it's pretty easy to track down and see. From that experience, I mean, I can imagine that you and your wife had a tremendous amount of fun with it. And to have just a glorious photo like that is an incredible keepsake. But the fact that so many people saw it, what does that mean to you?
Well, one, I could introduce myself as that one flaming lesbian, and instantly people would find me. Like, when they're like, oh, how do I find you? Do you have a business card? I'm like, no, just Google flaming lesbian bride, and no, trust me. I'm like the first, like, I would say half of the images that still pop up when you type in flaming lesbian bride, we show up. Like, it's not even hard to try and remember who I am, right? Beyond that, I think it was about 120 unique news stories, news reports across 40 countries. It reached out to a bunch of people, and we got a lot of support from the LGBT community. And unfortunately, it made me realize that there's still a lot of anti-LGBT individuals. I do have a very public personality, and we did receive rather negative commentary that caused me actually to write an entire article and do the research on whether or not it is more dangerous to light yourself on fire as a professional versus being openly LGBT. And if you come to think about it yourself, how many fire performers can you think of who have died because of a professional fire accident versus how many people can you think of who have died because they were openly LGBT that was then later on possibly killed or brutally harmed due to some type of hate crime. I live in Orlando now, which still has the largest death count of any single shooter hate incident in history.
Living in such an open way, I mean, obviously, as a person who loves to perform, that's exciting for you to be able to make a splash and really turn heads and make people think about something in a new way. But it also sounds very vulnerable. Do you have any regrets about that?
I wouldn't say I have any regrets. Each and every single turn I've taken given me a wonderful learning opportunity. There were several challenges through there, like dealing with a substantial amount of hate emails that I never thought I would receive in my life. I try my best to be a positive, open, honest, caring human being, and I did not expect such a large backlash. And because my image, my name, my website, my emails are all publicly available, like, it was quite astounding to be linked to and then receive messages from a number of individuals that didn't like me purely because I ended up marrying another woman.
I'm sure you've also inspired a lot of people, too. You probably hear a lot about that as well.
Oh, yes. And that's the part I hold on to. And I would recommend anyone who has to go through a similar issue where something they did ends up causing somewhat of a stir in their community, remember that you have so many more individuals out there who are willing to love and support you regardless of what you do in an endearing, or sorry, in a, oh, I forgot the word.
It's okay. You obviously, I mean, people, I'm sure, take a lot of inspiration, and I can imagine there are a lot of people who are as multifaceted as you who think, wow, maybe I can live my full life in all of these different aspects as well. April, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Charity. And the word was unconditional. That's what I was thinking of.
April Jennifer Choi. She is a NASA engineer, a model, a dancer, a fire performer, a world record-holding whip cracker, and many other things. She grew up in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.